So I'm in the Department of Psychiatry and Neurosciences. What is it? I can't even say it. Neurobiology. NPI, Neuropsychiatric Institute. Sorry. And I direct this brand new center that we have, the Center for Social Medicine. And what I'll be talking about, I've been working for the past three decades with homeless heroin injectors, drug sellers, and violent youth. And this first picture that we're about to bring up is a homeless encampment in San Francisco, where I followed some two dozen injection drug users for 12 years, analyzing their survival strategies and interface with medical services and law enforcement. The fieldwork actually is presented in a photoethnographic book that I co-authored with Jeff Shawn, who took all the photographs that we'll be seeing. They're about to come up. And I normally, oh, this is good because they haven't come up yet. I normally warn most audiences that many of the photographs are jarring I hope that I know that many of you are clinicians and routinely deal with extraordinary levels of pathology and suffering. And I think that the photographs are necessary for us to be able to believe the levels of the inconceivable levels of physical suffering of homeless heroin injectors, and also from a medical perspective, the extraordinarily unsanitary physical environments in which they live. But I did include one energetic, beautiful photo, just to give you a better idea of the energy that also exists in these sites simultaneously. So we were using, as Vivek was describing, the classic methods of participant observation ethnography. I didn't actually that frequently sleep in the encampments. I maybe did it a dozen or two dozen times. But participant observation, the classical anthropological technique, is actually quite powerful because it allows you to triangulate direct observation with self-report, and it becomes especially useful in when dealing with taboo subjects, illegal subjects, and subjects that people are ashamed to talk about or know that they're stigmatized. So I'll just run through briefly. I want to convey then, just in passing, I want to start with the potential of cultural relativism. And the anthropological sensibility more broadly, which can improve relationships with outcomes of difficult and non-adherent patients, most notably in this case, the homeless heroin injectors that I'll be talking about. But more importantly, this requires recognizing the structural vulnerability, the structural forces, and the cultural normative values that often result in these contradictory priorities between health providers and patients, and leads to a failure to understand the logics for the extraordinarily risky behaviors of many non-adherent patients. That leads us often into the all too commonsensical trap of dismissing these individuals as self-destructive pathological outliers unworthy of medical treatment and social services and empathy. So specifically then, what I want to do is operationalize the social science concept of structural vulnerability and the health risk environment to propose it as a practical clinical tool or even a simple quantitative checklist. Ideally, this could extend the medical purview beyond the biological and individual patient confines to more upstream institutional policy and supportive services, as well as infrastructural logistical interventions that either do not require behavior change or create the support infrastructure to achieve less risky lifestyle changes more realistically. So then very, very briefly, the concept of cultural relativism is just a heuristic technique, a tool. It's not a theory. And it's very, very simple. No culture is good or bad. It just has a logic. Our job is to understand the logic if we want to understand anything about why people are behaving the way they do in this cultural setting or this social setting. The concept of risk environment comes out of the 19th century social epidemiologist Rudolf Virchow, and who's also a pathologist. And it actually sort of continues through today. You can think of the work of Paul Farmer, the charismatic anthropologist and infectious disease global health doctor, who's chair of social medicine at Harvard. And the concept and specific dimensions one chooses to emphasize from the risk environment, some of which I listed here, also draw on concepts that I'm sure many of you have worked with, you know, from social determinants of health, eco-social models of health, upstream factors in health, and fundamental. There's lots of terms that are eliciting these concerns. Structural vulnerability is a more recent adaptation of a social science concept to medical care. And many of the forces and characteristics that comprise structural vulnerability are somewhat commonsensical. But they're commonsensical only if you have time to think about them in the pressured context of the very short clinical encounter. And so the goal of the assessment tool that I'll be presenting at the end of this, in the hopes that one of you will maybe invent an app for it, is to precisely allow this to happen without having to, you know, major in social sciences or even care about the social sciences to a certain extent. So in sum, structural vulnerability is a product of a patient's social position in the diverse networks of overlapping power relations and hierarchies in which all individuals, us included, are inevitably embedded. It's the outcome of a combination of one's assumed or attributed status, including subtler things like health-related deservingness, normality, conventionality, credibility, intelligence, imputed honesty, and so forth, as well as more easily and objectively measurable socioeconomic and demographic attributes that any given society hierarchizes and stigmatizes: gender, social class, race, sexuality, citizenship status, and so forth. And of course, then also policy trends mesh with these symbolic and demographic markers and institutionalized forces to position individuals differentially within specific political, economic, and institutional sites in ways that affect health and long-term outcomes. In practical terms, then, structural vulnerability is the confluence of forces that on some level limit agency and the ability to pursue healthy lifestyles. In the United States, the one I always try to bold on a PowerPoint is social class, just because it's such an extraordinarily invisibilized concept for us culturally. Stigma against non-normative or socially unconventional behaviors and illegal practices is also often misrecognized as just one's moral common sense, and becomes conflated with unworthiness. So I also wanted to emphasize that as well. But I'll be talking today about the legal status of heroin injectors as a structural as a force generating structural vulnerability. And I'll read from a field note excerpt that tries to show how the risk environment of zero tolerance policing emerges as a force fomenting injection practices that increase the risk of infectious disease for street-based injectors, and most specifically, it's increasing abscesses, but also increasing hepatitis C and HIV. So, the note then. There's been yet another round of evictions, and Hank is shivering on the corner at wit's end. He tells us, "The highway patrol wiped me out again." That means they bulldozed his shack, taking all his blankets, clean syringes from the needle exchange, clothes, and so forth. He adds, "I'm tempted to get my gun and shoot the next patrol car that I see." Max walks into the walks by and puts his arm around Hank's shoulder, attuned to Max's dope sickness, that is to say his oncoming opiate withdrawal symptoms. He was shivering and the mucus was running down his nose. He offers to treat him to a taste of heroin. They immediately run around the corner, down the alley, into Max's encampment. And to Hank's encampment and set a candle on a pizza box to prepare to cook a bag of heroin. But Max's syringe jams. Hank reaches into his sock, pulls out another syringe, handing it to Max apologetically. The highway patrol police took all my clean ones too. Max shrugs. He was evicted from his encampment last week too, and also lost all his clean syringes. But then he squints distastefully because Hank's syringes syringe has been used so many times that the numbering on the chamber is worn off. Cursing, he also notes a burr on the tip of the needle. Hank grabs it back, licks the point to confirm the defect, and quickly files it down on a rock, alternately licking and filing until he can no longer feel the burr with his tongue. Max is the one treating, so Hank deferentially hands the needle back to Max eagerly and waits for his turn to prepare what's called a cotton shot from the leftovers in the bottom of the cooker. And believe it or not, the homeless heroin injectors and crack smokers we befriended were all well educated about the risks of propagating blood-borne diseases, especially HIV, from injection drug use. And in some sense, this is a great sort of achievement of public health, that these messages are available and they're actually commonsensical on the street. Now, most of us, of course, would see this sharing between Max and Hank as obviously dangerous, unfortunate, and even irresponsible, or some of us might simply dismiss it as ignorance. But the health priority of a heroin user is to avoid opiate withdrawals above everything else. That's the number one priority. So sharing in this case becomes a social responsibility and also an expression of interpersonal friendly generosity and mutual care, as well as self-interest, because that obliges in the future the other person to share with you when you're in opiate withdrawal. In other words, Max is saving Hank from overwhelming, agonizing symptoms of bone-wrenching pain by giving him the dirty leftovers of his cooker and dirty cot. Max is also protecting himself in the future, because next time he is dope sick, Hank, as I was saying, will be willing to lend him the godsend of a dirty needle filled with his dregs. So we constantly saw this kind of reciprocal gift giving, including food, blankets, temporary shelter, et cetera. We also saw them stealing from each other regularly. One doesn't preclude the other. It's a sort of complicated thing. What was most interesting is that they almost always pooled money to buy heroin, because that is precisely what achieved the minimal levels of trust that are necessary and the familiarity that's necessary to keep them in community and familiar with the techniques of dividing up the equivalent amounts and fair amounts of whatever amount of money each one contributed. So from an anthropological perspective, these risky acts of sharing and gift giving form a moral economy of valuable reciprocal relations and reciprocal obligations. There's a survival imperative in the case of people surviving on the street who are addicted to participate in this moral economy in order to decrease their future risk of finding themselves alone and isolated, beset by withdrawal symptoms, and unable to go out and beg or steal or work to get themselves well again. Now, to better understand this logic for risk, you need to learn how to inject heroin on the street and how it gets split up accurately without the benefit of running water or soap or a safe private environment. The heroin that we have west of the Mississippi is known as Mexican black tar. The cartels have the country
divided up. On the East Coast, they have a fine white powder.
And this Mexican black tar doesn't dissolve well. It has to be heated in order to dissolve it, unlike the powder heroin on the East Coast. And it has to be stirred. Note how he, in this case, he's crushing it with the filthy top of his syringe in order to make sure that it's completely well dissolved. Then it has to be carefully measured as units in a syringe for equal division, so you can keep track of how much each person owes, how much each person's contributed, so that everyone can feel that this was a fair exchange, or else they'll start fighting with each other. It's not like they're saints with sharing. In short, to survive and avoid dope sickness, they participate then in this moral economy cycle of gift giving and debt, which forces them logistically to share common cookers, a crushed beer can in this case, and common rinse water and common cotton filters. So this, of course, directly contradicts public health's, biomedicine's understanding of moral and rational scientific behavior in the face of infectious disease. But for them, it's just practical and imperative to stay healthy, is to share. They do usually, as I was saying, avoid direct needle sharing. So it's not as if they're not listening to public health messages. In fact, they are listening to public health messages, and that's precisely one of the reasons why they avoid institutional medical settings. Their illegality, their non-normative, non-conventional appearance, and their forms of interpersonal interaction, which are sharpened to be rough and aggressive with each other to survive, are not received well in our medical settings. So they avoid those medical settings, and they don't generally come in to seek services unless they're starting to die or in extraordinary levels of pain. And instead, they invest in outlaw identities to pursue drugs with a self-destructive intensity akin almost to a devotion. They actually call themselves righteous dope fiends. That's an expression. And hence the title of the photoethnography that Jeff and I wrote about them. Now, here we can see how the criminalization, not just of heroin, but also of syringes, has pushed people into the absolutely worst place we would want them to inject. And this is sort of that where you see very clearly that structural force. This is in no one's interest to inject here, but it's actually the safest and, from the injector's perspective, the healthiest place to inject. Because what he's most worried about is getting arrested. In a liberal city like San Francisco, all the judges will throw out the arrest of a homeless heroin addict. They're throwing up in the courtroom. They smell bad. The judge just wants to get them out. They don't. They're not fighting the war on drugs in that kind of a way. The police are, however, and they know that the punishment is going through 48 hours to get processed to the courts, so that you get thrown into those withdrawal symptoms, and that's just for carrying a syringe. Or having a small amount on you. So from his perspective, there's no way that this is surrounded by a set of swampy puddles around. There's no police officer in his or her right mind is going to go running through there to arrest him. He can take his time and try to find a vein, or in this case, he's just muscling because his veins are burnt out. So in contrast, this is a safe injection site in Canada, where public health has prioritized concerns of bringing harm reduction, concerns of bringing addicts into safer spaces rather than zero tolerance policing. And the World Health Organization has recommended as a best public health practice for preventing HIV infection and active drug users this concept of harm reduction, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. I won't have time to do justice to the concept, but even actually the UN Office of Drug Control has declared it a best government policy. Although, ironically, our NIH project officers advise us not to use the word harm reduction when we submit grant proposals. It's just, our country is just way out of line with respect to that compared to most European countries. My grant actually was singled out as an immoral grant because I was naive at first and was using that kind of language, and it got investigated for that reason. There are no magic cures for the complications associated with substance abuse, but harm reduction does offer an effective strategy to reduce pain and suffering of people who otherwise have a very high mortality and morbidity. And more subtly, it prevents that hostile and negative iatrogenic interface with addicted patients, and with, it actually extends to any patients who have complicated chronic lifestyle caused conditions that are difficult to shake, and because whatever diabetes, cardiovascular disease, so harm reduction would work as just as well in those kinds of settings, as opposed to alienating the patient and having them retreat from any interface with services and just to give up or become more attached to their lifestyle activities that are making them sick. And as I was saying, so the examples of harm reduction are diverse. The most extraordinary, that's hard to believe, is countries that actually prescribe, it's too commonsensical to be believed, to long-term heroin injectors, they actually just prescribe them clean, pure heroin. Switzerland is the country that pioneered that and has had that as policy for over 10 years. And their outcomes are rather extraordinary. They have more people in the heroin prescription program going into pure abstinence, just completely leaving heroin, than the proportion who goes into abstinence from methadone programs and from abstinence-only programs. So it gives you an idea of how, because what happens is when you're getting the heroin, and when a nurse is sort of telling you, wash your hands and you're tough and you have scars and tattoos all over, you all of a sudden get bored with this act, or some of you will get bored with this activity. You actually have to figure out what's going on that make you have to have it every day. At least that's one of their hypotheses. They no one can figure out what, actually on some level why that has worked. And as you can just see quickly from headlines, it's in many countries it's just taken as common sense. Even the right and left wing parties are both for harm reduction in Denmark, for example. Now, in contrast, Sunny in this photo was just released from the San Francisco General Hospital with no painkiller after a deep carving and scraping of an abscess for which he had been avoiding treatment and that had gotten complicated. He was in excruciating pain from a gust of wind right here, didn't even have a bandage. There's a rigorous quantitative literature that actually, there was a long article in the New York Times yesterday reviewing, to my surprise, quite an anecdotal bit of it, on the black-white disparities in access to analgesic care in the United States. And it includes things like findings such as white children being three times as likely as black children to receive opioids in the emergency room for appendicitis. So the stakes are obviously high in the poor treatment delivered to vulnerable populations and to the negative cycles that that clinical services get into with respect to the population. And I just want to end, because we don't have time, given your extraordinary expertise, I wanted to just throw up here the structural vulnerability assessment tool or checklist, which is intended to extend the medical gaze and purview to integrated social services, supportive social services for medical conditions. And I uploaded to the Google Drive an article that we have in press in Academic Medicine, which is proposing this structural vulnerability tool for medical education and clinical settings in case there's someone who
might be interested in taking a closer look at it. And this builds on the growing literature that's available documenting the success of pilot programs that identify what get called high utilizers of emergency rooms or frequent flyers, more stigmatic in more common terms, in order to shower them with medical, mental health, and social services delivered by multidisciplinary clinical and social service teams. The questions in bold in each section then, within each domain of structural vulnerability, function as initial screens that could potentially be quantified. They're also followed by qualitative assessment probes to elicit more detail and context so that one could use this tool or checklist, either qualitatively or quantitatively. And it has, of course, this assessment tool, a broader agenda to reinvigorate and extend the traditional clinical social history, which is really done very routinely, if it's done at all. Beyond its narrow range of risk behaviors, to enable providers to address negative health outcomes imposed by social determinants of health. Strategically, it could also justify institutionally to the cost utilization review committees that terrify clinicians, the mobilization and coordination of complementary resources, both inside and outside the clinical setting for populations who otherwise are actually very expensive in addition to suffering. Now, ultimately, this adaptation of the social science concept into clinical practice could perhaps also orient healthcare providers towards more policy leadership to reduce health disparities and foster health equity. I think that's especially important in the United States with our extraordinary right-wing shift over the past 30 years. Health remains this neutral category and can say very subversive, very radical things in completely technocratic terms that are basically believed as a legitimate human right in general common sense, access to health, access to not suffering physically. So now, of course, the risk, and I'll stop with this, is that it would become yet another bureaucratic hoop on the computer checklist that distracts time-stressed nurses and doctors and social workers from the actual vulnerable patient who's in front of them. So I want to thank you for taking the time to listen, and Vivek for inviting me here, and I enjoyed being here with you. It was fun. Okay.